he kind of told you all the rules that if you want something taken out, just let me know, either as you say it or afterward. But thanks everyone for coming. I'm Holden Karnofsky. I'm one of the co-founders of GiveWell, at least the other one. I'm going to talk about the Open Philanthropy Project, which is still part of GiveWell. We are hoping that, you know, sometime in the near future, maybe a year from now, it'll be a separate organization, because we think that it's getting distinct enough and the missions of the teams are getting distinct enough that that's going to make sense. But I'm going to, you know, go over the basics of what we do and kind of give one example of the kinds of causes we're working on, and then I'll take a break and questions, and then talk about some of our other work, and then take more questions. And I'm going to shoot for around 9 or 9.05 to end this. So basically, Open Philanthropy Project, for those of you who aren't familiar, it kind of it has something in common with GiveWell in that we're looking for the best ways to accomplish good by spending money. And it started in 2011 when Ellie and I met Carrie Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz, and they were kind of looking for the best ways possible to do philanthropy, and it reminded us of the problem that we had had when we were starting GiveWell, except instead of, you know, Ellie and I, when we started GiveWell, had been trying to give away a few $1,000s, and we had like a few hours a year to think about it, and Carrie and Dustin trying to give away a large fortune and had several decades to think about it. So those are kind of the similarities and the differences right there. So, you know, Open Philanthropy Project is more targeted at good ventures, is more targeted at major donors such as Good Ventures, which is Carrie and Dustin's foundation. And, you know, the basic idea is that where GiveWell looks for proven, cost-effective, scalable charities, Open Philanthropy Project looks for important, neglected, tractable causes. And we try to find the best causes to work on, and then we try to hire around those causes, build staff capacity, build knowledge, build expertise, and become really good at working on the causes we've chosen, and then make grants in those causes. And that kind of takes advantage of the larger donor's ability to kind of build expertise, have more engagement, have more context, and also do things that aren't just writing checks to existing charities. So that's why the kind of unit is the cause instead of the charity. One of the very distinctive factors about what I call Open Phil as opposed to GiveWell is the emphasis on what we call hits-based giving. So we had a blog post laying out this idea a couple months ago, but the basic idea is that when you're doing high-risk giving, you may do a whole bunch of, you might support a whole bunch of things. And maybe for every 10 things you support, 9 of them completely fail and have no impact. And one of them has so much impact that it makes up for everything else combined. This is kind of, you know, conventional wisdom about how venture capital investing often works. And I think there's at least some flavors of philanthropy that I expect to work this way as well. So when you look back in history at some of the biggest philanthropic success stories, and we do look back at history a fair amount, we have kind of a project where we try to study the big successes philanthropy's had, you do see some that look so big, even though they were very risky at the time, that you can imagine a philanthropist kind of having a bunch of failed projects and having this one success that makes up for everything else. So the research that the Rockefeller Foundation did that has been credited for just, you know, getting maybe more than 1 billion people out of starvation is like one example of that, where it was kind of high-risk agriculture research. Nobody really knew where it was going, but you could have a lot of failures like that. You could have a lot of failures if you have one success of that magnitude. And so that's, you know, that's kind of what we're about. We do things other than hits-based giving, but I bring up hits-based giving to just give some context on some of the things we do and why they can, you know, appear a lot more kind of high risk than what GiveWell does, and oftentimes are a lot more reliant on kind of the expertise of the networks we've formed and the people we've hired, and a lot of deep context that we can't fully kind of put into writing and justify with evidence the way we do with GiveWell. Though we do try to write up enough of our thinking to help people follow along with the basics and kind of see what our basic approach is. So in terms of what we've done and our progress, you know, for our first few years, we were really focused on picking the causes we wanted to focus on. So finding good areas for a major philanthropist, finding things that were important, neglected, and tractable. And in 2015, we had kind of picked a bunch of causes to focus on, and we spent a huge amount of the year just hiring and building capacity and trying to, you know, get to the point where we had enough staff to really make a lot of grants. And in 2016, we have sort of got twice the size that we had at the beginning of 2015, and we do have a lot of specialized staff, And we do have a lot of focus areas that we're ready to make grants in. So for 2016, a much bigger focus has been actually getting money out the door and making grants, and that's some of what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to start by just going over the basic idea of our U.S. policy work and some of the work that we've done there, and that should illustrate the basic principles we're using and the basic things we're looking for, and then I'll take questions for a while before talking about some of the other things we're up to. So, a couple years ago, we started looking at the different ways we could get involved in policy-oriented philanthropy, and so that is kind of giving with the aim of envisioning a world with better public policy. And the idea is that if you were to support someone who's working to educate people about how policy could be better or do some of the grunt work needed to improve policy, you might spend a relatively small amount, but if you end up having an impact on policy, that can leverage your giving greatly. And so this is one kind of category of thing that we think could be very high impact. And what we did is we took a whole bunch of issues we could imagine working on, and for purely pragmatic reasons, we kind of started with a U.S. universe because that's where we were able to kind of understand the issues and form our networks, although as we've kind of gotten into specific areas, we've become more open to international work, and I'll get to that. But we kind of made a list of all the issues we could look at, and we tried to figure out which ones. We kind of took a lot of issues and estimated their importance in terms of if we could get a big policy win, how much value would that create for society? We looked at their neglectedness. In other words, we prefer to work on causes where there isn't already a lot of money and a lot of philanthropy and a lot of groups trying to push on the issue. So, you know, some issues we think are quite important and quite worthy, we think get plenty of attention already, and other things we think are equally worthy and get less attention. And then tractable, we do pay attention to what we think the prospects are for actually winning some victories, although I should distinguish that because as a philanthropic organization, we operate on long time horizons. And so when it comes to policy for us, tractability does not mean there's a big story about this in the news right now. If we move in the next 3 weeks, we might be able to make a difference because we operate on a scale of supporting organizations as they grow, and that time frame is just not a time frame we can operate on. And I think in general, if something's all over the news, the people who've been working on it for a decade are the people who are now going to make a difference. And the people who try to jump in now that it's in the news are probably, you know, at high risk of wasting quite a bit of money and effort, relative to the other people anyway. And so, so what tractable means to us is something more like there are deep structural factors that we expect to persist for a while that make it possible to get wins on an issue. And so an example of an issue that we have been drawn to for tractability reasons is criminal justice reform. So, you know, we believe that, well, we know that America incarcerates more people than any other country on earth per citizen. We believe that incarceration does not have a commensurate benefit in terms of public safety. There's little evidence that it does, and David Rudman is currently conducting a very massive review of the literature on this and kind of concluding that there's not a lot of reason to expect that with the current levels of incarceration that we're really getting much for that extra incarceration in terms of public safety. So we do incarcerate a lot of people. There's questions about whether that's actually, you know, paying off. And so we believe that there's a lot of humanitarian gain from sort of rationalizing criminal justice policy. But if that were all there were to the issue, there'd be a lot of other issues that are competitive with it. In our view, one of the things that has really made it stand out is the idea that there's momentum and opportunity to make change in this area in a way that a lot of other issues don't have. And there's multiple reasons for this. So one is that it's a state and local issue. And so you can pick your battles a lot more than with issues where the only venue you could ever possibly, you know, sort of make a difference in is DC, especially with the way that things work right now with Congress and the situation in DC. So, you know, another reason is just crime is a lot down since the tough on crime days. A lot of, you know, state budgets are tight. There's kind of some rare opportunities for liberals and conservatives to come together and say, we have opportunities to help the most disadvantaged citizens by cutting the size of government. You don't see that, you know, all the time. And so that is an example of a cause that we kind of were drawn to because we estimated it had high importance, though not as high as some of the other causes we looked at. and that it was kind of outstanding in terms of the tractability. And our first major hire was in this area. So we hired Chloe Coburn, who comes to us from the ACLU. She's been with us for about 6 to 9 months. She joined in September, so not very good math. That'd be about 9 months. You know, she basically leads our work on criminal justice reform. She works out of New York. She's not here tonight. But just as an example of one group that we've supported here, the Alliance for Safety and Justice is a group that has grown out of Californians for Safety and Justice. Californians for Safety and Justice is the group that led the campaign on Prop 47 in California that reclassified a lot of felonies as misdemeanors and therefore, in our opinion, kind of reduced the amount of time people are going to serve in jail and prison in positive ways. It was a really well-run campaign, and now the people who did it are trying to bring their skills to the national stage via the Alliance for Safety and Justice. And we, you know, we believe, based on our relationship with Chloe and her relationship with people in the field, that these are some of the best people in the field, that they're some of the best positioned to do a lot with a lot of resources, and we've given them substantial unrestricted support. So there was a $2 million grant that was announced, that's, you know, that's an example of the kind of thing we're doing, where it's not, you know, we didn't take this group and find 10 randomized controlled trials for the work that they're doing to change policy. It was much more we picked the cause, we picked the people based on networks, and we looked for someone who could use money and who needed money and who had that kind of great reputation and great track record in a softer way. So that's criminal justice reform. Other example, and then I'll take questions. But farm animal welfare is a cause that we put high on our list because the importance, I think, depending on exactly what your philosophical views are on how to sort of weigh the suffering of animals, but the importance could be very high. There's a lot of animals that are treated very, very badly on factory farms right now. And, you know, we were also felt that this cause was relatively neglected. And kind of we felt kind of neutral on tractability, weren't sure what to think at the time that we made the hire. But now Lewis Ballard is leading our work on that. And I don't know if he's here tonight, but he's in town right now. There he is. And so, you know, when we started our hiring process, Lewis came to us and actually told us some things we didn't know at the time, which is that there actually has been big signs of tractability, and there's been a lot of momentum around cage-free reforms, and so around sort of lobbying corporations to make pledges that they're only going to sell eggs that are cage-free. And this started with fast food and moved on to grocers. We believe that, you know, cage-free eggs, they're not perfect. We still don't like the way chickens are treated under cage-free systems, but we believe they're a lot better. And we also believe that it's a really good thing for this movement to get some wins. We think that's going to be good for the long-term growth of, you know, this brand of animal welfare and for the long-term prospects. And so, you know, we made a series of grants, the Humane League and Humane Society and one other than Mercy for Animals. Yeah, that was kind of our first set of grants, was to support the work of three groups doing this and get them to do it in as accelerated a manner and as ambitious a manner as possible. And shortly after we kind of, you know, made our recommendations, they, you know, we believe that we helped them plan these efforts in a more ambitious and speedy way, and they have recently been winning quite a few victories. It now kind of looks almost inevitable that the U.S. is going to be sort of almost just like a cage-free country in terms of groceries and in terms of fast food, and that's going to affect a huge number of chickens and more generally be just a big win of the kind that we think is important. So, you know, those are examples of some of the stuff we've done so far. I'm going to pause and take questions before talking about the rest of the work that we're doing, but that's the basic idea. Questions? Yep.
Can you just real quick explain like what the divisions are? Like, if I give money to GiveWell, how much of it is it? Is it going to the Open Philanthropy Project?
Sure.
And just why, yeah. Like, what's the basic relationship?
So, relationship between GiveWell and Open Philanthropy Project, and what happens if you give money to GiveWell? So right now, Open Philanthropy Project is just part of GiveWell. It's in the same organization. And if you give to GiveWell unrestricted, that means that you are supporting both. You're just, you know, it's going into one pot of money. That is something we're looking to change. So we're looking for the two organizations to become separate, but that could be a pretty involved process, and it could take a long time. You know, if you want to support GiveWell without supporting the Open Philanthropy Project, you can certainly say so when you donate. Also, if you give to GiveWell and you restrict your donation for grants, it will go to top charities. At that point, it's not really part of the Open Philanthropy Project. But that is, you know, that is the current situation. Yep.
You said that you think it's pretty likely that the cage free movement will end up succeeding at this point. To what extent do you think that was helped by organizations like the Humane Society, Mercy for Animals, and to what extent were those organizations in turn helped by GiveWell?
Sure. So what's the impact of the groups we supported on cage-free, you know, wins, and what's the impact of open philanthropy on those groups? So the first one, we kind of feel like the answer is, you know, huge and essential. And I'm going to, you know, maybe Lewis, you should jump in if I'm wrong about this, or maybe you should answer. I mean, you know, Lewis certainly knows a lot more about this than I do, and all I'm doing is kind of repeating stuff he's told me. But, you know, we definitely think that those groups, we just don't really see any reason to have expected any of these pledges to happen without the work they were doing. We believe that, you know, there was no reason to think grocers and fast food companies were just going to decide to go cage-free. They were under pressure to do so. They were being lobbied to do so. So we think, and we don't know of other groups doing this, and we believe we would know if they existed. So we think that's just an essential connection, and basically you can, you know, put 100% of the impact there. In terms of our impact on the groups, I think that one is dicier. They already had some wins when we started talking about supporting them. And, you know, all we tried to do was speed them up, make them more ambitious and faster. I think there's, you know, definitely an argument that we sped them up a noticeable amount. I think there's even an argument that if they hadn't moved quickly, that there could have been a lost opportunity because some of these companies were investing in these enriched cage systems. And once the, you know, capital investment is there, that's going to be a harder pledge to get them to make. So, you know, there's some possibility of that, but I would say in this case, you know, I would say that it looks like a pretty strong case that we made things faster and more ambitious. I don't think that we were like the only factor there at all or a primary factor. I think, you know, most of the credit goes to those groups. Yep.
So I also recently heard about another victory that the Humane League has won in terms of eliminating chick culling. Is that something that OpenPhil had a voice in, or was that a separate part of their work that you were not involved with?
So, I mean, the question about the Humane League recent victory on chicken culling, you know, how involved were we in that? I mean, look, one of our kind of philosophies as a funder is we are not generally doing contracts. We're generally doing grants. And so, you know, what we did do with these groups is we made the grants and we made it clear that we were trying to support corporate campaigning. I don't think that we said this is only for cage-free. I think that we said, you know, this is for corporate campaigning. This is what we think is the most promising branch of farm animal welfare work right now. And so I think this is kind of a tough question to answer in the sense that, like, probably they worked on this chicken culling thing because they had won victories on cage-free and were looking for the next thing. And so I think in that sense, it's connected. And I think that our funds are, like, bound up in that work. It isn't something that we, like, asked them to do. It's also not something that we asked them not to do. It was more like an example of the kind of thing we were really happy that they did and were, you know, trying to support. Does that sound right, Lewis?
Yeah, I would say even more than that, and very briefly, that it was the cage-free campaigns that brought the United Egg Producers to the table with the Humane League. They were very explicit that they were only meeting with the Humane League because they had so much success with the grocers. And that's what allowed the Humane League to credibly say they would campaign on this issue and to, without any campaigns, succeed on this issue, was that they'd shown with their previous campaigns on cage-free that they could succeed. And then it comes back to the question of what role we had in those campaigns. And in the Humane League's case, we tripled the size of their campaign team, but they still would have had campaigning without us, so you have to guess what their campaign was.
One of the things you're observing here is something different about OpenPhil and GiveWell is that knowledge is more distributed. And so,
well,
you know.
Well, we have Josh and Natalie talk about their.
Yeah, true.
Too,
yeah, okay, fair point. I think the thing I'm trying to say is that we do, like, you know, my job sort of at OpenPhil is to work really hard on picking the right causes and hiring the right people for those causes. And then the gulf between, like, what they know and I know is, like, quite extreme. And I think it's bigger than for GiveWell. Though with GiveWell, stuff that's in progress is you know, is more that way. But I think with GiveWell, there's much more of a mission to take the conclusions we're reaching and really write them up so we can cross the full bridge from, you know, not knowing anything to understanding the full case. And with OpenPhil, there's much more of a sense that we're hiring people who have deep context who have, you know, extensive networks, and I can't keep up with everything they know and everything they're doing. And so the goal is to, you know, be really good at picking the causes, picking the people, and then, you know, we have a lot of interaction in terms of, like, asking questions about what they're doing, but it is fairly high level, and a lot of the philosophy here is to kind of trust the program officers to lead the way and to, you know, be in the lead on setting those priorities. They do get questioned a lot, but it's a different kind of basic model. Other questions? Yeah.
Do you feel the need to see the causal connection between the giving and the impact, or do you not feel that need?
Do I feel the need to see the connection, the causal connection between the giving and the impact? I would say yes and no. I mean, I would say that when a grant proposal comes into my inbox, I'm asking about causal connections forward-looking and probabilistically. So, you know, a grant that makes me very excited is when I can say, I think this has a decent chance, maybe like 10%, maybe 20%, so not necessarily likely, but a decent chance of making a really big difference to something really important. And if you multiply that through, this is a great value for money, kind of in expectation. And when I'm thinking about whether something has a decent chance of succeeding, I like to play out causal stories in my head and to imagine that, you know, I can imagine what's going to happen, or at least examples of what's going to happen that's going to result in good things. Though there are multiple models of grants, and so I think there are some grants where we really just believe in the people or the institutions we're funding. We don't know exactly what they're going to do. We know they've done good stuff in the past, and we're just trusting them and figuring that we'll come back in 2 years and we'll see something good, and we don't know what. And that's a kind of grant that we make. And I can name like several grants like that. I think ASJ, in large part, is like that, the Alliance for Safety and Justice. I think the corporate campaigns, subject to being corporate campaigns, are like that as well. You know, so I think that's definitely a model. And then there's other models where, let's say that we know what's going to happen, and we think that thing that's going to happen is good. So we do both. I like to be able to have examples of causal impact, either in the past or just examples of good things that could happen. And then, you know, in terms of watching for results, I think there is an attitude. The attitude we try and take is that a lot of these grants may be operating on very long time horizons. It may be very hard to isolate the impact. And so we have to be kind of patient and willing to do things that look good forward-looking and just have a very long time horizon and a big portfolio for looking back and seeing how we've done. So I think the corporate campaigns have been successful, like, more and faster than I expected, but I think that's kind of the exception. And there have been some other wins that I would say, you know, have already been exciting, but for the most part, we kind of expect to learn how we're doing more like by looking across the whole portfolio after 10 years than by taking each grant and marking off, you know, milestones. Does that make sense? Cool. Other questions? Why don't I talk about some other causes we're doing? So I talked a little bit about the policy influence category. Another category for us is global catastrophic risks. So, you know, we think a very good fit for philanthropy is working on worst case scenarios, because if you imagine that kind of the, you know, you imagine something happening like a pandemic, you know, the very, very worst pandemics imaginable are way more damaging than the kind of like only really bad pandemics, but they're not necessarily way more unlikely, even though they're way more damaging. And so I think there's a general feeling about global catastrophic risks that the things that could be so damaging as to kind of destabilize civilization in general are not the kind of things that any other institution really has the incentive to work on, other than a philanthropist, and that we might be able to have an outsized impact by improving society's preparation for things that can have kind of global and long-run consequences by being very disruptive. So a couple years ago, we made a list of all the things that we could imagine going wrong and being very disruptive to global civilization. And we had asteroids on there, and climate change, and antibiotic resistance, and a whole bunch of other stuff. And we did the same thing. We rated them by importance, neglectedness, and tractability, and kind of ended up with two main focus areas that I would say, you know, are the two things that I think are probably the most likely to have kind of a really globally destabilizing, like threatening human extinction or just a real change to long-term trajectory of civilization. The two causes that I think are the most likely to be in that category. And, you know, one of them is pandemic preparedness and biosecurity. So, you know, I actually do think that whether a natural pandemic, which has been behind some of the biggest tragedies, you know, globally to date, or a synthetic pandemic as synthetic biology advances, if I were trying to come up with things that could really knock civilization off course in the next 100 years, that would be near the top of my list. And then the other cause that we've made a focus area is potential risks for advanced artificial intelligence. This one obviously is a lot like less intuitive to immediately see the case for. And I myself have a history of kind of, you know, changing my mind a lot on this issue. So it's a long thing to get into. I'm not gonna, you know, kind of recite the whole set of blog posts that we put up to explain our issue, to explain our interest in this cause. But I would broadly say that that if and when, and I think no one really knows if and when, but I think if and when we get artificial intelligence that is powerful enough, that can do enough things at a superhuman level, that is one of the top candidates for just massive changes across the globe, because most of the changes we've seen across the globe to date can be attributed to human intelligence. And something that was, you know, noticeably more powerful than human intelligence in a large number of relevant domains, for good or for ill, could be one of the most transformative things that has ever happened. And we believe that there's a series of reasons to believe and a series of potential risks, that if, you know, if things go a certain way, you could imagine either very catastrophic accidents where you have a powerful artificial intelligence kind of trying, in some sense, optimizing for an outcome that's not human-friendly, or misuse. I think if you imagine that powerful enough artificial intelligence would be a very powerful weapon, that weapon in the wrong hands could be globally catastrophic. And so, you know, we believe this is an area that is definitely speculative. I know it sounds a little science fiction-y, but we also think it's real. We think there is kind of a real chance that something very transformative is going to happen via AI in the next 20 years or so. Lots of reasons why we think that, written up in great detail. Well, not great detail, actually, but written up in some detail on the blog. And we believe that it's a pretty neglected space. We believe that it's, you know, partly because it's a little bit out there, the set of people trying to prepare for these unlikely but very high stakes risk is not as big as it could be, and we believe that as a philanthropist we can help build certain fields. So those are the areas we're working on. I should mention climate change, which would also be, you know, the third thing on my short list of things that could really be huge. I think climate change is one of the biggest risks facing humanity. I also think it's like a lot less neglected, especially by philanthropy, than the other two. And I think the very worst cases are kind of like probably not as likely to be as bad as with the other two, and that kind of would be a long conversation too. But we have those two causes, and on biosecurity and pandemic preparedness, we have Jamie Yassif and Howie Lempel working on that, and they're both focused on that cause. And Jamie joined us recently, so we've made only a few grants so far, but I expect that in a few months we'll have a lot more to say about all the work we're doing trying to improve pandemic preparedness across the globe. And then Ellie Hassenfeld is actually managing that work. So that is probably, out of all the causes I'm saying tonight, that's going to be the one I know the least about, because Ellie is kind of doing the supervisor role with that particular work. And then on potential risks for advanced AI, that is something where Daniel Dewey is working for us full-time. He was a contractor last year, and he converted to full-time this year. And then also, like, several generalists are spending time on this cause, including myself, partly because we think this is a very important cause and a big opportunity at this stage, especially as kind of interest in the issues is growing, and we think there's opportunities to get things done really well or really badly. And also just because it's a particularly kind of like young cause where the networks are not very well developed and the field is not very well developed. And so it feels right now very time intensive, and it feels like we need to find staff time where we can find it if we're going to position ourselves to do the kind of work in this cause going forward that I think we're already able to do on criminal justice reform and pandemic preparedness and farm animal welfare. So those are, you know, other causes we're working on, and I'll just kind of quickly hit, you know, other stuff that we're doing because we're not done picking causes. So we have a, you know, we've recently had several people, or will have several people, come on to help us explore the world of scientific research, which is one of the hardest categories to explore in terms of, you know, things we might recommend funding to that could be really good value for money. Daniel Martino Arcon is here. He recently joined us as a full-time science advisor. We have two other people coming on full-time in the next couple months, and so that's a cause that's taken us a long time just to get the staff to do the cause selection, but eventually, hopefully, we'll have some focus areas. And then, you know, there's other work we do. I mean, we have the History of Philanthropy Project, but I'll leave it at that for now and spend the rest of the time taking questions.
Jamie's here, too.
Hello.
Yep. Sorry, I didn't just see you. Yeah.
What's going on with History of Philanthropy?
What's going on with History of Philanthropy? So History of Philanthropy is basically we tried to go through all the books we could find and all the literature we could find on what philanthropists have accomplished in the past and what we can learn from what they've done. And we have kind of a big internal list, and actually an external list too. It's called Philanthropy Success Stories, of kind of candidate cases where it is claimed that philanthropy made a big difference. We have started the process of really deep diving those cases by actually contracting with historians who then go try and check things out. So, you know, for example, supposedly philanthropy played a role in the passage of Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. Is that really true? What were the key organizations? What role did they play? Who funded them? How did they decide to fund them? Ben Soskis, a historian that we work with, wrote up a really good case on that I really like, and it's public, and it's on our History of Philanthropy page. We blogged it. You know, other cases that we've been interested in and that are coming out either recently or very soon. There's two organizations that we not only have found to make pretty good cases that they've had a lot of impact, but also that we believe philanthropists had like a major role in founding, not just supporting. And so there's the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, which is a group that kind of works on pro-poor, sort of pro, you know, poverty-reducing work in the U.S., and they try to be part of like budget debates on Capitol Hill. And we believe they've had like a lot of impact and really made, you know, had some high leverage wins. And then there's a group called Center for Global Development that we've supported significantly. It's an example of a group that actually we've supported them without really having a, you know, set of deliverables. And they're a group that works on how to make rich country policy more beneficial for the global poor. And they also, you know, both of these groups we believe were kind of like, at one time there was a philanthropist who said, I believe there should be an organization like this. And they went and found the person they thought would be best to lead it. And then they funded that person and trusted them. And they certainly didn't run things. They certainly didn't design things. But they did initiate things. And we think that's really interesting because it's kind of counterintuitive to me that that would ever work. And so we, you know, I think a week or two ago, we published, you know, we published Suzanne Kahn's study of the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities and how that got started. And then tomorrow we're going to publish Ben Soskis' study of how the Center for Global Development got started. So, you know, this is basically the work, is we have this list of things that look interesting. We have historians check them out. We publish the case studies. It's not something we spend a huge amount of time on. It's something we do with contractors. And, you know, we kind of get the case studies done as they get done. And then there was also recently a new book that came out that lists like an even larger number of success stories that we're going to try and go through by the end of the year. It's called The Almanac of American Philanthropy. So, you know, it's not a huge use of our time, but it is us trying to learn what we can from history and especially kind of really closely scrutinize the successes and say, were these real successes and what can we learn from them? Yep.
How do you think about the neglectedness of strong AI risk in terms of the, like, semi-research new interest in philanthropy around it in Silicon Valley, especially like Musk and YC? And
yep. Yeah, so how neglected is the field of potential risk for advanced AI? This is something we've kind of looked into a lot and had a lot of conversations about. You know, one thing that is true is that over the last couple of years, there's been a big jump in interest. I would say in AI generally, in just, you know, in the general prospect that very powerful artificial intelligence that is kind of, you know, superhuman performance in a wide variety of domains could be coming sooner than people had previously thought. And I think that is due to technical advances that just took a lot of people by surprise. And especially, you know, deep learning is kind of a class of methods that has shown to just have really exciting and broadly applicable effects. So there's been a lot of excitement about AI, and with that, there's been kind of a surge in interest about risks from advanced AI, and certainly a lot of press and, you know, stories with kind of like Terminator pictures. You know, we believe that despite all this, it hasn't really translated to a lot of philanthropy. And it hasn't really translated to a huge amount in the way of what we really want to see, which is people working full-time to do things that could reduce potential risks. Like, to us, you know, stories in the newspaper don't reduce potential risks. Hype doesn't reduce potential risks, but people working full-time do. And we think the amount of those has gone up, but it hasn't gone up a ton. And the amount of philanthropy has gone up, but it hasn't gone up a ton. Specifically, I mean, OpenAI, which I think that the groups you're naming, that's their main project. OpenAI is a nonprofit research lab focused on, you know, basically focused on creating, on researching, on accelerating AI. It is not a group, like, it is not a group whose mission is to, I mean, I think it is interested in safety, and I think there is some research going on there, but I think if we come at this field with a mission of saying, we want to help the subfield of AI research that specifically works to reduce risks. We want to see that field grow in academia. We want to see there be kind of jobs at all the labs for people who work on that stuff. And we want to see the field of, you know, strategic and policy preparations to reduce misuse. We want to see those grow. And I think while OpenAI is interested in reducing potential risk, that's not their day-to-day work. And so I think when you look for people who are doing, you know, who are trying to bring about what we're trying to bring about and can comparably sort of recommend donations, I think that that's not, you know, it is not a crowded field from that perspective. Other questions? Did I answer them all? Yep.
What sort of policy sort of preparations are you guys thinking about with the AI risk? Is that about like job removal from AI, or is it about other things as well?
Sure. So what kind of policy preparations? I mean, this is something that we've so far only been pretty speculative about. Like, we haven't made grants yet. We want to be careful, because the thing we don't want to do is start just, you know, funding anyone and everyone to start talking about policy around AI. Because, for example, I mean, I don't think it would be a good idea for AI to be regulated today. I just think it's, you know, the stuff that one might want to regulate is too far off. And I think that the harms would outweigh the benefits. So we want to be careful, and so we're very preliminary on that. But I would say our primary interest is in minimizing the risk that there's either going to be some kind of, you know, arms race type dynamic with AI, or there's going to be a very powerful AI in the hands of, you know, some, like, basically either a rogue or an authoritarian government, someone with very bad values. Those are the things we're most worried about, is kind of that dynamic. You know, the whole idea of AI causing unemployment, we think, is also an area of interest, but we think it's probably going to be a slower developing thing, and also is like a little bit less neglected than the kind of issue I just talked about. Yep.
Can you characterize how you are allocating your focus between more speculative open fill topics and your more traditional GiveWell work?
Sure. How do we allocate focus between speculative open fill stuff and traditional GiveWell work? Mostly right now it's, you know, most staff kind of work on mostly one or the other. I work on open fill. So that's, you know, that is my focus. That is my job. I'm still on the board of GiveWell. I still participate in debates about what the top charity should be and how much we should recommend. But my involvement there right now is like pretty high level, and most of my time just goes into trying to build the open fill team and work on that stuff. Whereas Ellie mostly works on GiveWell, though he also is, you know, is involved in a lot of the open fill discussions and also is taking, you know, that supervisor role on the pandemic preparedness. Sure.
What sort of discounts do you guys do for like human to animal lives, and then also for future lives versus present?
Yeah. How do we value human versus animal lives? How do we value present versus future lives? The more options you put on the table as a philanthropist, the more you confront these really foundational and sort of impossible philosophical debates. I think a general principle we have is to avoid a situation where everything we're doing is only good if you accept a particular philosophical position in a very contentious debate. I think that is like what we don't want to do. And as a group recommending a lot of funding, like, we don't necessarily have to be in a place where we just have to pick one. And so, you know, we do try and do some degree of saying, if there are multiple ways to look at an issue, if there are multiple potential reasonable perspectives, if there's several ways of resolving these questions that we could imagine ourselves really believing 5 years from now, then we want to sort of in some sense be making some bets on each one. And I think the reason, there's a couple reasons for that. So one is that I do think that anything you do as a major philanthropist has sharply diminishing returns. So for example, you know, we look at the field of potential risk for advanced AI, and we're kind of saying anyone who's good who can work to reduce these risks is someone who we would love to recommend funding to, and we're really looking for people to fund. And so, you know, kind of similar with farm animal welfare, where there's, you know, there's a set of groups and we're trying to make everything as aggressive and as fast as it can be, but there's limited capacity. And so it's like, if we all decided that we count animals equal to humans and we don't count future people at all, and so we're all going to work on animals, it's like, I think we could get more done on farm animal welfare, but I think we'd hit super diminishing returns. And I'm much more attracted to the idea of saying, you know, if it turns out that farm animal welfare is the best cause in some sense, like something we'll never know, but let's pretend we could someday. If it turns out that that's the place to be, or we decide that's the place to be, then we will have already done an enormous amount of good by those lights. We will already have a program. If we decide we want to put more resources into the program, we'll have the capacity and the staff and the knowledge to do that. But then the same also applies to potential risks from advanced AI, and the same also applies to criminal justice reform and pandemic preparedness. I think that's a better situation to be in than to say, you know, put everything behind one set of philosophical views and say, I really hope we're right, because we think that, you know, these views really could change. And I think that I certainly would hope that anyone with enough resources to do all these things would do them if their values on these tough philosophical questions were different from mine. And so that's also part of the thinking. So the bottom line is, like, we do try and take any perspective that we could really imagine ourselves, you know, being tempted by or holding in the future is something that we want to, you know, recommend some resources into addressing. And I think that hopefully gets around having to have a totally nailed down view. I mean, honestly, like, my own, like, current best guess at philosophy of mind and how you want to weigh animals versus humans, that has varied a lot. But, like, even on days when I don't think that we should worry about animal suffering, like, I'm glad that we're doing something about it, because it would be very easy for me to be wrong. Yep.
So you talked about, if we decide in the future that this is more important, change our views in general to the value of information, and holding out that option value, you might get that information later. Any plans to actually support the gathering of that kind of information, or some, like, in 5 years, will there be some big open fill funding of research that might prioritize along those lines?
Yeah, do we have plans to fund the research that can help us, you know, understand these issues and gain clarity on these issues? I would say this can mean a lot of different things. So one of the ways we learn about our work is we just look back at things we've done and we see how they went, and that does change our view of things. And so that's, you know, that's something that we do expect to do. It's not where we're focused right now, and it might be a few years before we really put a lot of energy into a look back, but it's something I eventually definitely want to do, and it's something we do informally now. So, like, our, you know, we had a meeting, very recently where we all kind of went over one person's, you know, recent grants and just kind of informally talked about how they were going. That's, like, one category. Another category you might have in mind is kind of, well, I'll tell you one thing that we're thinking about doing. When you think about estimating, like, doing kind of a back-of-the-envelope calculation of how much good you accomplished with a grant, there's a whole bunch of kind of, like, sub-questions that you run into, such as, I won't go into the details on these, but what discount rate should you use, and how should you value kind of, like, dollars of economic value added to the U.S. versus dollars of economic value added in the developing world. And there's a whole bunch of, like, little empirical questions that could give us more clarity on a lot of how we compare across these different causes. So we're, you know, it's possible that sort of, like, after he's done with the criminal justice work, that David Rudman will make this, like, maybe his next big project, and he tends to be very thorough, so that, I think, would definitely teach us a lot. You know, there's another category of, you know, well, what about funding philosophy to try to, like, figure out the answer to philosophy of mind? I mean, I don't know if that's actually possible. I don't know how tractable that is. It is something that has come up. It is not something we have, like, active plans to do. But I would generally say that, you know, if we see opportunities that we think, where we think we can, especially if it's, you know, more, I mean, if we see opportunities where we think investing time and or recommending grants can leave us better informed about how to trade off different causes, we'll be pretty excited. And so people who know about ways to do that or think about ways to do that should let us know, because we're generally open to it. It's not like a super active focus area at the moment. Take a couple more questions. Yeah.
My question is about how OpenFell approaches cases where the number of people and dollars on the cause is relatively small, and GiveWell or OpenFell and Good Ventures might have an outsized power to influence the direction. Like in the example of animal advocacy, where there's kind of a long-running debate, both strategically and morally, about incremental welfare approaches like cage-free eggs versus like vegetarian and vegan advocacy.
Yep.
And so grants of these sizes, have a significant influence on how that can go. So how do you all think about that power in some cases?
Sure. How do we think about sort of power to shape the field when the field is very small? I think mostly we definitely don't want to distort people away from things that they like believe in. So we definitely avoid relationships with grantees where we're sort of saying, here's something you have no interest in doing and we're going to make a contract with you that sort of forces you to do it. But something that we are quite willing to do is, if there's a grantee who's willing to go in one of several directions and we have the ability to recommend money that would be, a big part of their resources, and we have a strong opinion that we believe is informed about what work is better than other work, then we're just, we don't really see any reason why we should do anything other than support the work that looks most impactful to us. Of course, the important thing there is to try really hard to get it as right as we can. And so part of that is, I think I wouldn't want to be the person with the limited attention I have. I wouldn't want to be the person trying to figure out all on my own if incremental welfare reforms are more promising than vegan advocacy. But I think Lewis, pretty much thinks about this all the time and has heard from the people on both sides at length, knows the arguments, has engaged in the debates, has the networks. And so I feel better with, him leading the way, me asking a lot of questions. We did put out a blog post, on this particular issue, which I think is contentious, vegan advocacy versus, sort of cage-free type reforms. This is an unusually contentious issue for us to wade into. And because of that, we made, a bit of an unusual effort to put our thinking out in public, give people a chance to challenge it, see if there were arguments out there that we were missing. And we did have that post on why we actually do believe the incremental reforms look like a better deal than the vegan advocacy.
I saw that you recently made a grant to Philip Tetlock to support his work on forecasting. He's like fairly well known, so I was kind of curious why he couldn't get funding from another source, or like what kind of what went into that.
Sure. Philip Tetlock, why couldn't he get funding from another source? Isn't he well known? I mean, it's not that he had no funding. It's not that he was, sort of totally out of money, but we are excited about his work. This was a one-off grant. This is not in a focus area. This is just something that, we do a very, very small amount of one-off grants when we kind of have the staff available to do them and when we're excited about something. And so Philip Tetlock is someone whose work a bunch of staff were like really excited about and really familiar with. We asked him, are you basically funded to do everything you'd like to do, or is there stuff you'd like to do that you don't have funding for? And he answered the question. He gave us a proposal. We thought the proposal looked like something worth funding, and so so we did it. And that's our general approach to the Room 4 funding situation. I mean, in general, I would say it's I don't think it's usually a safe bet that people who get attention or press are well funded. I think it's a bit of a complicated relationship, and certain kinds of press or certain kinds of well-knownness are really good at bringing in the money, and other kinds don't correlate as well as one might expect. Cool. Well, I don't see any other questions, and it's 9:06, so I feel like I should let people go. And I will hang around for a little while. I have to run at 9:30, but I will hang around probably till then. So thanks, everyone, for coming. We really appreciate all the, you know, all the engagement, all the great questions, and people like you who make it possible to do our work are just, you know, really awesome. So thank you.